living some little men and women. They are our past. And maybe they are our future.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KPFZ 88.1 FM, Lakeport, Clear Lake, and all of Lake County. You're listening to Inside Out. Stay tuned for a very interesting report about the Middle East by Jesse Eisenstadt, a young journalist from San Diego. So how are you?
I'm doing good. How about yourself?
I'm fine. You're getting ready for a big trip.
Yeah, that's correct. I'm getting ready to go to the Middle East, starting with Israel and then to a number of other countries, Palestinian territories, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. Who knows where else it will take me?
You said something surprising to me yesterday when we were talking, and that was that people may be more fearful than they should be about these countries in terms of traveling in them. Tell us about that.
Just kind of as a freelance journalist, it's always kind of interesting because you're on the other end of the news spectrum and you can get to kind of immerse yourself in these cultures and these people. It's amazing that the news stories totally do not reflect the news on the ground. A lot of these Middle Eastern countries, culturally, they're very hospitable and not particularly violent. I mean, you stay out of a number of hot spots, and it's a very calm and mellow place to be. Media has done a good job, and perhaps to sell more newspapers or whatever, but to make the whole region look like it is the war zone or it's this big, scary beast or something like that.
How do you manage to stay out of the hot spots? I mean, you're getting news. I'm really impressed with you as a young man going into one of the hottest spots in the world, you might say, and really trying to give us a clearer picture of what's going on over there. How do you manage to do that?
Well, I think the best example of the trip that I'm doing is the West Bank is generally regarded as the most dangerous place that I will be going through. I think Roger Cohen, actually an American Jew himself over at the New York Times, wrote a great piece the other day on Hillary Clinton's meeting and voyage into Ramallah, which is the de facto capital of the West Bank. He basically wrote that sometimes there's a shock going from first world Israel into donkey cart Palestinian territories. And there is, but I think most people also need to realize that the Israeli Defense Force and going into the West Bank, it would be a lot different than if you were just an American going into the West Bank, going as a tourist and foreigner. The hospitality is amazing. People really look after you. Even though it is regarded as somewhat of a war zone, there's really a sense of pride and dignity. People have been traveling to these places for thousands of years, and this is tourists really are nothing new, and there's a hospitality that's been ingrained into many of these people. It's really quite remarkable.
You've been there before. How many times?
I did a trip for about 6 months, 2 years ago. I went to Turkey, Lebanon. I got to view Lebanon right after the 2006 Israel-Hezbollah war and kind of observed and wrote about infrastructure devastation along with other things. And made my way down to the United Arab Emirates, Israel. And I ended up doing a volunteership program in the West Bank city of Nablus, which coincidentally, I guess, happened to be during the coup in 2007 where Hamas and Fatah militias were clashing, and that's, of course, when they took over the Gaza Strip, Hamas, that is. Then, of course, they tried to take over the West Bank, but that didn't quite work. So I was kind of there for that little spurt of violence.
So you were there for 6 months at that time?
Yeah, that's correct.
And have you been back since then?
I have not been back. I've been building my website, which is bloggingthecaspa.com, and we have a...
Okay, C-A-S-B-A-H.
Yeah, that's correct. And it's the whole thing is Caspa, a transliteration from French to Arabic, and what it is, it means like the old, like in the Algiers Civil War, there's the Caspa. And then, of course, the ridiculous Looney Tunes Pepe Le Pew character was a ripoff of that whole thing as well.
Right.
So the website basically tries to give a view of the Kasbah, the old city, and what it looks like. And we have one of our kind of teammates of bloggers is a journalist in Bethlehem right now, so we get a pretty good view of what's going on the ground there.
So what drew you to this area initially that made you want to go there and want to be a journalist in that area, at least to start with?
It's quite remarkable. You know, I get this question all the time. So do so many other people my generation. And the simple answer is, it is the story of our generation. The Middle East is on one level where most of the resources are. It is where the tension is. It is where American troops are on two fronts right now. And then yet on another level, this is where humanity learned to walk out of the desert into civilization. Report right after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, trying to, you know, kids from Tennessee who are in the army and the invading coalition of the willing, so to speak, and they stumble across the Al-Askariya Shrine in Sumara in southern Iraq, and they're just blown away. They've never seen anything like this. And there's an enchantment in the Middle East that is just, I just haven't found it anywhere else in the world. I mean, this is really the roots of humanity are intertwined in this region.
Especially the ancient lands, ancient countries, and what they've given to humanity to date is extremely remarkable in terms of the great religions and the philosophies and the beauty of Persian rugs and, I don't know, music and so forth.
Yeah, if I could just add one point to that. You know, I've always thought that if the world were to rotate on one axis, if there's going to be one city of the world that were to be diverse and represent kind of humanity, I guess, it's got to be Jerusalem. I mean, just in the old city, if you have four quarters, that would be the Armenian, the Christian, Muslim, and the Jewish quarter, and the whole city is just mixed and just represents all these histories. The last of King David's wall is, you know, right next to the Dome of the Rock. It's incredible.
Have you been interested in history for a long time?
I have been, but it's a piece of the puzzle, you know, because, you know, you find Jews in Israel who like to, you know, brag about using the Old Testament as a Lonely Planet type book, if you will, to just walk through the hills. There's a modern element that is, you can so see the modern and the ancient intertwined that it's pretty cool. That I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, it's an interesting place.
Are you a practicing anything at this point? Are you drawn to any religion? Or were you brought up in any religion that still is with you?
I'm not particularly religious. And I guess that question a lot, too, because a lot of people would think that there is some kind of religious, you know, you have to be religious to be into it on that level. And, you know, there's plenty of, I guess, secular people who are just find it interesting. And the modern politics of it all are just about as interesting as it gets. It's interesting on a myriad of dimensions.
With all this enormous spiritual energy that's in that area, the Muslim, the Jews, the Christians, I don't know what else is over there. But why does the Middle East seem to be constantly a subject of trouble and despair? I mean, why can't these men of reason and of great spiritual thought get together and find a solution?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. There's obviously a number of reasons. I think one important thing to realize is this whole concept of nation states like Saudi Arabia or Kuwait or you know, Iraq for that matter, they're all relatively new concepts. The whole place used to be, just really 100 years ago, most of it was under Ottoman control, the Ottoman Empire, which would be, you know, modern-day Turkey.
Right.
And so you had a tremendous amount of trouble converting all these lands into nation-states. Most of them are Arab countries, of course, with the exception of Iran, which is distinctly Persian and not Arab, and then Israel, of course. But you know, you had Arabs and Jews living together in the Middle East pretty harmoniously for a really long time. People, the generation before me, who I know this Iranian man who said that, you know, he's about 50 years old. He said his dad's generation, his dad wouldn't go to anyone else in Tehran, Iran, the capital. He wouldn't go to any other doctor other than a Jewish doctor. And that was like his sticking point. You know, same is true in modern-day Israel, too. Jews were regarded regarded as excellent in medicine and so on and so forth. So this friction is really not as ancient as certain people like to think.
Right. The Obama administration has identified three goals in the Middle East, finding a two-state solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, a stable Iraq that operates under the rule of law, which doesn't seem to be doing that well right this minute, and going after al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. In what priority are these issues being addressed, and what do you think about them? How do you envision that potential?
Well, it's very interesting. President Barack Obama just summoned King Abdullah II, King of Jordan, to the White House for a talk about a week ago, and he was the first Arab leader to come to the White House. And basically, you know, obviously I wasn't there, but I think he basically asked the king, he said, hey, look, you know, is a two-state solution still possible? And he just asked him just straight out, because there's plenty of other problems that he's got to deal with right now. And the king said, yeah, it is still possible. Part of that would mean stopping Israeli settlements, so on and so forth, and guaranteeing security for Israel. That is the underlying issue, I believe, in the Middle East. George Bush thought that the key to the Middle East is through Baghdad, when, in fact, the secret to peace and stability in the Middle East is and always will be through Jerusalem. And finding some kind of accord and solution would just end and unlock a number of other issues. One thing Obama didn't clarify in this plan was the Iran issue. And Iran is currently engaged in a sort of cold war with the United States. I mean, Iraq, Lebanon, Afghanistan, the Palestinian territories via proxies and whatnot. And figuring out something to do with the Israeli-Palestinian issue would unlock so many other avenues, would just go so far in reducing tension.
Are you talking about having some accommodation from Iran, that you're saying that?
Yeah, Iran is definitely a piece of this puzzle. We can't ignore Iran as a player in finding a two-state solution any longer. I guess the conventional wisdom was before the United States went into Iraq in 2003, is that Iran and Iraq always served to balance each other in this kind of way. But now that, you know, secular Saddam Hussein and his Ba'athist party is taken out, we basically took out Iran's biggest foe, and they've been able to just impose kind of a cultural imperialism, as I've heard it be described by this news, over just so much of the Middle East. So a lot of our problems in, say, Iraq and Afghanistan and the Palestinian territories can be dealt with through addressing Iran, but it's also got to come down on the Palestinian issue, because that is the number one recruiting point for terrorists and people who want to join various insurgencies against the United States.
And there are parties, I'm sure, who don't want an accord there. In other words, it feeds their overall animosity toward the West. Do you think that's true, that it can be used, that they actually like to stir it up in order to keep up the larger battle, which is perhaps based on religion or so-called religion, you know what I'm getting at, the philosophical differences?
Most of these groups that you're describing are of Islamist groups, and there's really three types of Islamist groups that exist in the Middle East today. There's these internationally driven ideologues, such as al-Qaeda or other groups, are focused on global issues, and they'll move into local communities to do something about it. But they're really kind of globally oriented.
Right.
Then there's kind of these local nationalist groups like Hezbollah and Hamas, which, whatever you think of them, they have local nationalist interests. I think, the third one would be groups, Islamist groups that have been absorbed into the government and demonstrate peacefully. But the point is that all three of these groups, to some degree, can benefit or may not benefit in ongoing turmoil. Especially Hezbollah, there's been a lot of talk with this election coming up on June 7th in Lebanon about whether or not Hezbollah will actually, with more control in the capital of Beirut, if they'll actually, you know, start to put down their guns and militias and stuff like that. And, of course, the cynics would say there's not a chance. They need this ongoing conflict to be able to sell their message to their constituencies. Right. There's totally truth in that statement.
I have sort of shied away from the Middle East all the way through. I think I've told you this because it was so overwhelming to me, all the different sects and all the names are difficult. It's a very foreign culture to me. So I haven't really kept up with it very well. But what I'm wondering is, you know, there has to be hope someplace because way back with Carter, when there was a peace accord, there are accommodations that each of these countries can gain from each other. I guess really from the little bit I know, and you have to correct me, but the Palestinian question and then right now seems kind of hot because of the polarization between Israel and Iran with two kind of strong leaders who are oppositional. Does that play into it?
It certainly does. One thing to keep
just
in mind,
personalities, the personalities that have gotten into office that
yeah, that's such a good point. There's a professor, Dr. John Schlesinger. He's a Jewish Holocaust survivor from Austria originally, and he teaches down here in San Diego at the University of San Diego. And he has this formula, and he always says, you know, I just can't believe nobody else stumbled across it. It's so easy. It's so simple. And it's really just the pragmatist versus crusader paradigm. It is particularly focused on leaders. And basically, to sum it up, it just says, you know, look, if you can get two pragmatic people sitting down at the same table, everything else can go out the window. These people can work it out, and historically, they've proven that they can. And I think that as we see the temperature rising between Israel and Iran, this is basically another word for deal time in the Middle East, or it can be. Iran has new presidential elections on June 12th. Israel just sworn in a hardline government led by Likud leader Benjamin Netanyahu. You know, it's not out of the question. A lot of these conservative guys or leaders in the Middle East, you know, you can say what you want about them, but they definitely have an easier time making peace because they come from the most critical factions. We're getting close to a breaking point on Iran and Israel. I wouldn't be surprised if we see deal time coming up, so to speak.
Somewhat.
We see a deal being struck with Israel and Iran to ease the tensions or something.
It's almost like there's so much risk in it on both sides. It's like during the Cold War, you know, the United States and Soviet Union at that time had to make a deal sooner or later, or everybody just dies. There's just no upside to a big nuclear holocaust, so you just have to find a way to accommodate. But what I'm wondering with these two extremists, on June 12th in Iran, what are the hopes for new leadership? I think it's very obscure, is it not?
You know, it's kind of the million-dollar question. I think a lot of Americans and just people all over the world tend to view President Ahmadinejad, the hardline guy who, you know, you definitely, if you know, seen anyone on Iran on television, you've seen this guy. He's the president, but you also have to look at what the president does. In the 79 revolution in Iran, led by the Ayatollah Khomeini, he developed a new kind of Islamic republic, so to speak, where there's a supreme leader, which is clerically supposedly a source of emulation, and he really calls the shot. The current leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, is really in charge in Iran. He's a bit of a recluse. He doesn't do public interviews, but he's the guy that analysts are really looking at. Is this guy really going to be accommodating, or has he figured out that the survival of the Islamic regime in Iran, which most Iranians just flat out detest, its very survival is linked to anti-Americanism and playing the role of the underdog, and our country has been messed with by the West for so long. He's got a personal news outlet that is about as much of an interview as he gives.
I want to go back just a couple of minutes before we get to the end of our interview, because it's going to be shorter than we thought. I'm wondering if you could tell us, first of all, a little bit about your background. And you are in school down in San Diego. Which university?
It's the University of San Diego.
Okay. And you're studying what?
I study international relations and political science.
Are you actually studying journalism itself?
I currently I'm not studying journalism. I do write a weekly piece for the university newspaper down here.
Uh-huh.
And I bounce around as, I guess, a freelance journalist, so to speak.
You do some things in the Santa Barbara paper, too, do you not?
Santa Barbara paper.
You're a contributor.
I had a piece in the Ma'an News Agency, which is the biggest Palestinian news outlet, and just various places, you know, just the definition of freelancing is literally freelancing.
I just wanted to get a bead for our listeners on who Jesse Eisenstadt is, who we're talking with. I have seen you through Skype, but we have not met. But we hope to be in touch. I hope to be in touch with you after you leave through Skype and bring some news and reports from time to time, even as often as weekly, if you're available in some way, to get those on the air and begin to have at least a radio outlet for you in this country. And then that would hopefully go out through other social networks that KPFZ is forming and that I personally am forming through Skype and Twitter and there's a new one called, I think, NIN or something like that. And, you know, try to get things out as much as possible for your impressions. It would be fun. And it would certainly be educative for me and for our listeners. So we're going to try to do a little bit of that, right?
That sounds great.
And certainly we could get probably some of them on the Pacifica website, we hope. I want to go back to the questions. One of the big questions is how the U.S. and Iran could unfreeze these decades of poor relations. You know, what common issues would they have to work with? Is Afghanistan one of them? I don't know what you mean by the salability in Iraq. You mentioned that. Could you address that?
Yeah, it's a great question. It really builds off what we were talking about earlier on how the Middle East used to be empires. There's been more than one, you know, Persian empires, which is Iran, that have spanned more or less throughout the Middle East. And there's a lot of communities that have lasting ties with Iran. A lot of them are Shia Muslims, as Iran is a Shia Muslim-dominated country. And, I mean, geez, you know, you can go just about anywhere and find these places. But I think Afghanistan is a really good place to look because it's kind of the next thing vis-a-vis American foreign policy in the region. And basically how it breaks down is President Obama is sending 17,000 more troops to Afghanistan, which is going to be essentially doubling our presence there in only about 6 months. Afghanistan, though it looks like a country on the map, it's really essentially created by the British and others, and it's made up of warring factions and different ethnicities. It is a whole number of different places. It really never has had a true centralized government and is notoriously hard to conquer. But where Iran comes into this is Iran has pretty close ties to what is called the Northern Alliance, which is an anti-Taliban coalition of northern warlords. One of the things that seems to just be lost in the fray of things is that when the U.S. invaded Afghanistan to take out the Taliban, which in Afghanistan, which supposedly, you know, was harboring Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, Iran significantly helped the United States in this operation because Iran has very little in common with these radical Sunni fundamentalists that, you know, are the Taliban. They have significant interest in not seeing these guys in control of Afghanistan. This is the perfect window of opportunity where Iran and the U.S. can work together again, which is finding a peace in Afghanistan. If Iran feels that they're next on this, quote, axis of evil thing, if, you know, you look at a map, Iran is in between Iraq and Afghanistan, two countries the United States has effectively changed the regime in the last few years. So if they feel threatened, they're not going to want to work with us. But if they feel that we're going to respect that regime, I think that we can start to see a lot more cooperation on the part of the Iranians.
Right. What is the long-term ambition of Iran as connected with Afghanistan?
Well, as I said, the Persian Empire spanned through much of Afghanistan. And a lot of people think of Iraq a lot like Afghanistan, where you can just set up a giant security apparatus, basically shoot your way or pay people off, and that's the solution. Afghanistan is not that kind of place. It's very decentralized, and a regional solution is, how I see, really the only sustainable way to find peace there, which would mean bringing in countries like Iran and Pakistan and India and Russia, and making sure that you create an environment where Islamic extremism is not allowed to thrive. And doing that is going to be much cheaper and much more stable and leave a much lighter footprint in this sensitive region in the long term. Setting up a huge security apparatus with guns and trying to basically kill your way out of it has proven not a viable solution.
Right. Well, Afghanistan would be like conquering Switzerland in terms of just the terrain alone. Not really the same at all, but it would always harbor radicalists, I would think, in one way or another. With your trip, in addition to all your political reporting, also a while ago you said something about Iran being the cultural imperialists of the area. They are ahead of everybody else economically, Iran?
Well, economically, the country is not, it's kind of a textbook on what not to do. They have incredible inflation. It's not a model of sound government. The U.S. could definitely help Iran getting their economy back on track.
Okay. And this would be the blind leading the blind right now, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe we work together somehow. That would be an interesting marriage, wouldn't it? Good, very good point. Why were you planning to take a surf trip from Israel to Lebanon?
Oh, yeah. This is kind of the other side of the work I do. You know, you can get so caught up in the seriousness of talking about, well, Iran wants to do this and Israel wants to do that. And there's this hysteria that people get into that is, it just blinds them from reality and just kind of the general beauty of the place and the people. I'm from Southern California, and I grew up surfing when I was there last time in Israel. And I was fortunate enough to get somebody's surfboard and go out for a little bit. And I just thought, what better vehicle for a story to tell than surfing from Israel to Lebanon? It's really the same coastline on the Mediterranean, but since the creation of Israel and the Arab Wars and whatnot, the border's closed. So it would be a drive from San Diego to maybe Oceanside or Los Angeles here in California would be just impossible. I mean, the border's closed. So my trip is going to start out with surfing in Israel and then carrying my board through the West Bank, through Jordan, shuffling passports because you can't have an Israeli stamp on your passport to go into Syria.
Are you going to have two passports?
Yeah, I've already, the State Department will give you a second passport if you have a reason like this. I'm going to get my second passport stamped in Jordan, so it looks like I flew into Jordan, into the airport in Amman, and then go into Syria and look for a transit visa to just basically take me across into Lebanon, and then, of course, surf the Lebanese shore. It's just remarkable that this is what you need to go through. This is how separated these countries have been just by everything. So, to me, I guess, it's a trip that is a total hassle on one part. I mean,
because you have to carry that board.
You got to carry the board. You got to go to all these other countries just to go north, you know.
Right.
Few hours by car. That's the point, you know, is that it's a trip that I hope is going to show the hospitality and the understanding and the underlying point that, well, a lot of these leaders, as you said, feed off resisting one another. The people are pretty mild, they're understanding, and they're hospitable, and they're open to it. And kind of the soft power of being a California kid with a surfboard showing up saying, you know, hey guys, you know.
Right.
It should be an incredible trip.
Oh, it sounds absolutely wonderful. You said something about going to Libya, did you not?
No, I'm not planning on going to Libya anytime soon.
Is that dangerous?
You know, it is considered dangerous, I guess. They've really opened it up. Gaddafi's son is supposedly much more moderate and much more of a pragmatist. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why Libya stopped its nuclear program, I think it was in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
look what happened. Libya's been doing pretty well the past few years. A lot of people have used the Libyan model for Iran, actually. As having some Jewish roots in myself, I've talked to a lot of other Jews about this. It's quite a moral issue. I mean, there's a lot of people who think there's Nazi-like camps in North Korea. We just don't know. Very interesting and troubling crisis.
Right. Well, I've seen some interesting things in my lifetime. I was in the Soviet Union when the Cold War was going on, and that was during the Reagan administration. We were trying to get rid of long-range missiles at that point. Not that it's mattered since they've come back, I think. At any rate, that was the real arms control issue at that time. I was staying right across the street from the Kremlin, meditating every day, you know. Meanwhile, all the Secret Service people were coming in and out of my room and all that kind of thing. It was very kind of an interesting time to be there as a journalist when I was in Washington. And then it wasn't long after that, the Soviet Union completely reorganized and changed its whole government, and it was a very, very hopeful time in the world. And I remember when the Berlin Wall fell, it was something no one ever thought would happen, and it did. So I'm strangely hopeful that out of this hostility that's going on between various nations over there, that there will be some accommodation that each can find with enough other countries to have the wallop they need to negotiate in peace. And I think you are a great representative of that principle. We are going to have to get off the air in a few minutes. This is KPFZ 88.1 FM Lakeport, Clear Lake, and all of Lake County. This is Tyra St. John on Inside Out, closing off. Stay tuned for Our Stories, Our Lives.